From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, playing tambourine on Marvin Gaye's Heard It Through the Grapevine and other stories of hit-making at Motown Records. We meet vibraphonist and tambourine player Jack Ashford and pianist Joe Hunter. They were part of the group of musicians known as the Funk Brothers, which backed up Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, Smokey Robinson, The Supremes, The Temptations, and Motown's other stars. The Funk Brothers are the subject of the new documentary, Standing in the Shadows of Motown. And we remember one of Israel's founding fathers, Abba Eban. He died yesterday at the age of 87. We'll listen back to a 1992 interview. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Chief Weapons Inspector arrived in Baghdad today with an advance team of about 30 experts. The team will prepare the way for inspections to begin as early as November 27th. Meanwhile, Iraq has once again fired anti-aircraft missiles at U.S. and British planes patrolling the no-fly zones in Iraq. The White House said the attack is a violation of the resolution passed 10 days ago by the United Nations. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
White House Deputy Press Secretary Scott McClellan said the latest incident involving the no-fly zones constitutes a, quote, material breach of UN resolutions, which require Iraq to disarm. McClellan said that resolution also mandates that UN weapons inspectors have total access to any site and that there be no aggression toward any UN member nation. The Bush administration says it has a zero-tolerance policy and that serious violations of the UN resolution could trigger a military response. The U.S. did react by bombing Iraqi air defense systems in the northern no-fly zone. All of this played out as UN weapons inspectors were arriving in Iraq. The White House called their arrival another step toward disarming Saddam Hussein. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
A federal appeals court in San Francisco ruled today that a U.S. coalition could not represent the al-Qaeda and Taliban prisoners being held at the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The coalition of clergy, lawyers, and professors had sued on behalf of the 600 prisoners, demanding that they be provided with lawyers, brought before a U.S. court, and informed of the accusations against them. The court said the members of the coalition had no legal standing to represent the prisoners' interests. U.S. intelligence officials have concluded that the recent audio tape broadcast from the Middle East, purporting to be the voice of Osama bin Laden, is almost certainly genuine. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
The tape surfaced a week ago on the Al Jazeera television network based in the Persian Gulf state of Qatar. In it, the speaker praised recent terrorist attacks against a French oil tanker near Yemen, against U.S. Marines in Kuwait, and the seizure of a theater in Moscow by Chechen gunmen. Many experts and officials in the U.S. and the Middle East said they believed the voice was that of bin Laden, but the U.S. government reserved its judgment until the tape was analyzed by American intelligence agencies. Intelligence officials believe the tape as it was broadcast was not altered or edited. They say bin Laden was reading a prepared text, probably sometime in the past few weeks, in which he urges his followers to mount new attacks, not only against the United States, but against Western European nations as well. The tape is the first firm evidence that bin Laden was not killed during the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 92 points to close at 8,486 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 17 to close at 1,393. This is NPR News. Attorney General John Ashcroft says he'll start immediately to implement broad new guidelines for wiretaps and other surveillance of suspected terrorists and spies. An appeals court ruled today that the government's interpretation of the guidelines doesn't overstep the bounds of the new USA Patriot Act. Civil liberties groups say the Justice Department could be eroding the privacy of law-abiding Americans. A judge in San Francisco says he'll decide by mid-December who owns Barry Bonds' record-setting home run ball. Judge Kevin McCarthy heard closing arguments today by lawyers for two fans who claim ownership of the ball, which is worth an estimated $1 million. Jason Lopez has more.
Last year, Barry Bonds set the record for the most home runs in a season when he hit his 73rd into the right field bleachers of Pac Bell Park in San Francisco. Alex Popov, sitting in the outfield seats, says he caught the ball in his glove amid a mob of fans, but another spectator, Patrick Hayashi, contends that Popov dropped it. It was Hayashi who eventually emerged with the prize from the melee, so Popov sued last year in what has been a contentious battle for the baseball. Videotape shows that Popov had the ball in his glove for less than a second. An appeal could drag the case out for years. For NPR News, I'm Jason Lopez in San Francisco.
The Agriculture Department is stepping up its oversight of meat processing plants in an effort to get them to test more widely for the potentially deadly Listeria bacterium. The USDA ordered its inspectors to do intensified testing in meat plants that don't do their own testing or don't share their data with the government. The order came after an outbreak of listeriosis in the Northeast that left 7 people dead. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from IDI, innovative developer of distribution and warehouse facilities coast to coast, on the web at IDI.com. IDI, we get things done.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you hear that Motown hit, you probably think of the singer Marvin Gaye, the songwriters Norman Whitfield and Barrett Strong, or Gladys Knight, who also had a hit version. But do you think of the tambourine player who helped kick it off? You would if you saw the new movie Standing in the Shadows of Motown. It's about the musicians who played on Motown Records, who became known as the Funk Brothers. They played on the recordings of some of the biggest soul pop stars of the 60s, such as the Supremes, the Temptations, the Four Tops, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, Smokey Robinson, to name a few. Standing in the Shadows of Motown was inspired by a book of the same name, which told the story of Motown's great bass player, the late James Jamerson. The author of the book, Alan Slutsky, is one of the producers of the new movie. Only 6 of the 13 Funk Brothers are still alive. 2 of them are my guests. Pianist Joe Hunter joined Motown in its early days in 1958, after Motown founder Berry Gordy heard him playing with Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. Jack Ashford joined Motown in 1963 and played vibes and tambourine. We just heard him on Grapevine. Here's how he joined Motown.
Marvin Gaye took me to Motown. I met him in Boston. I was working with a jazz group, and he came in and had mentioned to me that he was getting ready to go on a road with a band, and would I be interested in going? And so I said, well, you know, what kind of guarantee is it? Because I'm already working. And so he says, well, I got a record out. He asked me, had I ever heard of his record? I told him, no. And then he said, well, have you ever heard of me? I said, no. And then he asked me, had I ever heard of Motown? I told him, no. And I didn't tell him, but I'd never seen anybody in a green suit either. So... we kind of hit it off because I didn't know anything. So he said he would get in touch with me, so we exchanged phone numbers and everything. And a few months later, I got a call from Harvey Fuqua, his brother-in-law at the time.
He used to be with the Moonglows, and
yes,
he was a producer,
that's exactly
too.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they wanted me to leave Philly and come up to Detroit to meet the rest of the guys he was considering to be in the band. And so when I got there, it was a tremendous experience. I hadn't ever experienced anything like that before when I first went into that studio. For one thing, Berry Gordy Jr. opened the door for me. And I was raising Cain with him because I'd been out there for 10 minutes banging on the door and nobody was coming to the door. I didn't know who he was, so I wasn't making any mistakes.
Doesn't sound like was a very good start.
Yeah, I started off on left feet the whole way. But when I got into the studio, I saw all these musicians and everything in this little room in the snake pit, which we affectionately called it. And I saw, as I look back, it was Stevie Wonder, Clarence Paul, the Funk Brothers, Barry, Marvin, Smoke, everybody was in it, all in this little room. I said, this is amazing.
Now, I'm wondering...
This won't last long.
Famous last words. I'm wondering when Marvin Gaye realized that you didn't know who he was, you'd never heard his record, you didn't know Motown, why did he think that you would be such a good fit if you didn't know the music at all?
Well, I could play. So that's what he was really interested in, you know. He liked the way I played. I was playing vibes that night. And then before he left that night, I switched over and played tambourine on a jazz song. No one ever really heard a tambourine on a jazz song. And he was kind of taken with that.
We'll get back to the tambourine in a second. Joe Hunter, you got to Motown at the very beginning. What's the first session you remember playing on?
Well, I remember playing under Marvin Johnson's Come to Me. That was the first session that I played on. And later, all the way down to Shop Around, it was a lot of tunes in between that that never did. It was just stuck in the can. But there was another of the Contours. Do You Love Me was one of the more outstanding tunes that I thought would never be a hit that became a major hit for those Contours.
Why did you think, it's a great recording, why did you think it wouldn't be a hit?
Well, because I wasn't used to the kind of accentuations that were going on, the breaks, the dynamics and whatnot. And it just wasn't my speed, even though I did them. But it just wasn't my thing. I was more into the George Shearing area, you know, that kind of jazz music that I loved. And those little things, little idioms that never did occur to me, but it was Barry's idea, and his idea won over.
Do you remember what you played on Do You Love Me?
Oh, sure. A lot of little syncopations, upbeats, downbeats, beats that I'd never heard nobody emphasizing, you know.
Okay, well, let's hear the original recording of Do You Love Me. This is the Contours, an early Motown hit. My guest, Joe Hunter, on piano.
You broke my heart 'cause I couldn't dance. You didn't even want me around. And now I'm back to let you know I can really shake 'em down.
Contours, Do You Love Me, an early Motown hit. My guest, Joe Hunter, on piano. Also with us is Jack Ashford, who plays vibes and tambourine, also was a musician for Motown Records, and they're both featured in the new movie, Standing in the Shadows of Motown, which is about the Funk Brothers, the Motown house band. Jack Ashford, let's talk about your music. You played vibes as a jazz musician before joining Motown, and also did a little work with the tambourine. How did you end up playing tambourine? I'll tell you, I was listening to some of the Motown hits, just listening for tambourine, and I found tambourine in a lot more places than I thought. There's so many tracks where you're kind of like playing on the same beat as the drums, and it's really effective, but I don't know I ever realized it before.
Well, when I first went there, they were limited to tracks in order to record on.
Mm-hmm.
And so
you can only do like four tracks at a time.
Yes. And so in order to get the instrument, see, when I started at Motown and started playing vibes, it was one thing, and they discovered that I could play tambourine.
Mm-hmm.
But Marvin Gaye really was interested in my tambourine playing. So when they would see me live with Marvin and see what I was doing with the tambourine, that made them very interested in that. So I would have to sit in the same booth as Benny Benjamin on drums.
Mm-hmm.
And I would use the same mic on the sock cymbal that he was using as the mic for the tambourine. So in order to balance it, since they couldn't mix it down once it was recorded that way, I had to move to and fro space, you know, from the microphone till they got a balance that they thought was acceptable. But of course, during the course of the song as it was going down, you know, I'm moving around, I'd get maybe a little closer or play a little harder, but they couldn't control that, and so whatever they ended up with is what they were stuck with. And so when they liked the feel of it, but it was kind of loud, if you remember correctly, the earlier Motown things, they said that they had to go with it. So they sent it overseas to England, and Sir Joseph Blackwood of EMI, who was going to distribute the Motown product over there, said that later on, he said that the tambourine was so high, he thought it was going to be a disaster. But when they started playing the Motown product over there, the tambourine was high, and then everybody across Europe started putting tambourine loud on their records the way we had ours. And so it made the product a success and welded my shoes to the Motown family.
So that's interesting. Had there been more separation or more tracks so that you could have been recorded and remixed,
right,
you know, on a separate track, the tambourine might not have ever been so prominent.
And might not have made it possible for me to be talking to you today.
Right. Now, you mentioned it was Marvin Gaye who really singled out the tambourine and encouraged you to play
yes.
it on the Motown tracks. His
right.
version of I Heard It Through the Grapevine, there's great tambourine on that, and you hear it right at the top, or kind of like really sizzling, almost rattlesnake-like tambourine beginning. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, that I developed that sizzle, which I call it, not with Marvin, surprising as it may seem. I developed that with Norman Whitfield, because we also use it on Smiling Faces with Undisputed Truth, when it said, beware of the handshake that hides the snake. And shh. And when I did that, boy, everybody went crazy. They said, what is that he's doing? And so it became very popular to use that little technique, and I've used it many, many, many times since then. And anyone can put it in there, but to make it smooth is something else.
Let me tell you, the truth is in the eyes, 'cause the eyes don't lie. Amen.
Remember, a smile is just a frown turned upside down, my friend. So hear me when I'm saying, smiling faces sometimes.
We heard Jack Ashford on tambourine. We'll hear more from Ashford and Joe Hunter after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with pianist Joe Hunter and tambourine and vibes player Jack Ashford, two of the Motown musicians featured in the new documentary and performance film Standing in the Shadows of Motown. When we left off, we were talking about Ashford's tambourine playing. So, Jack Ashford, did you ever get tired of playing tambourine? Did you wish you were playing vibes more or kettle drums? Or?
Well, you know, I was forced to play the tambourine. When I was working with the jazz group, Charles Harris Organ Trio, we were losing it in this particular club in Boston, and Charles said, we're not going to be able to pick up the next week if we don't come up with something to bring more people in. So that day, he went out and bought a tambourine from someplace. And I didn't look at the tambourine with disdain, but I'd always associated it with a storefront church. Mm-hmm. I'd never played one. I'd never held a tambourine before. So he told me, so when you're not soloing, pick the tambourine up and play. I said, what am I going to play? So he says, you think of something? I said, I can't think of anything unless you're going to be playing Near My God the D. It won't fit. So we were playing Take Five by Dave Brubeck. And so he hollered across and said, pick the tambourine up. So I was drugged, believe me, because to me this was a put-down. So I picked the tambourine up, and I started doing something, and the tambourine, God knows, it took on a life of its own. I know that was spiritually driven, because I was looking at my hands like I was looking at somebody else play it. And it was working. I mean, it was doom da 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 da. Boy, the club got packed. By the time the next set started, people were talking about a jazz tambourine player down the street. And they had emptied the other clubs out to come to the club where we were. So they extended us for 4 more weeks. And so it started, as I said, it started taking on a life of its own. And then I saw that people liked it. So then I started concentrating on it more, you know, to try to develop it into more than just an additional thing in a church. And by doing so, it began to make more demands for me to play that. Because, see, you can get a vibe player because he's going to play the music. But a tambourine requires spontaneity. It's by the frequency that it's in. You don't have to play it hard because it's going to cut through. And I'm beginning to know, to learn, rather, the benefits of the tambourine.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had to start creating some beats that no one could get, which would single me out from everyone else that would try to play it.
What were some of the beats that you came up with?
Okay, well, it's like you got you've heard War by Edwin Starr. Well, when you hear that, I put a pickup in there that no one else has been able to do. But not only that, you know, I'll tell you something. It was a taboo for a tambourine player to take a pickup with a drummer. And I'm one of the few tambourine players that can take a pickup with a drummer, won't get in the way, you know. And it also evens out movement of time. Like some drummers may speed the time up a little bit or lag back. And I have an ability to play it and level it off so you don't know that he moved. You know, it became a real timekeeping instrument until it was amazing how I used to cover up a lot of deficiencies in the drum tracks.
Can you, like, tap out some of the beats that you used on the tambourine?
Let me see.
Sounds complicated for tambourine.
Well, the tambourine would be easy, but controlling those cymbals on there so that they don't get in the way.
Mm-hmm.
Playing the tambourine is one thing, but controlling the cymbals is another ball game.
Joe Hunter, let me get back to you. Joe Hunter is a keyboard player and was a member of the Funk Brothers, the Motown House Band. The records at Motown, there was a very elaborate process for producing records. There were, I think, weekly meetings that Motown had in which it was decided at this meeting which new song was going to be done by which group and who was going to produce it.
It wasn't always decided. They would have somebody in mind, some artist or some group, and it end up being the song end up going to another group. It's whoever sound the best on it. They might test 2 or 3 different artists on one band track, and you could say the...
So it'd be like a competition.
Competition, that's right. Whoever did it best and whoever they decided, they had a woman up there, what's her name, Billie Jean Brown. Yeah, well, she was her...
Quality control.
And she had a good ear for music, and a lot of times she would pick, and they would say yes, oh yes. Then they also had counselors at high schools. They would go in testing records on, and the council would vote a certain way. And they went with that, too.
And when you were performing on a track, were you given, like, an arrangement to play, or did they just tell you to play what you thought would work?
Well, most of the time we were given a chord sheet, and sometimes they would tell us to put our own feelings in these chord sheets. They wouldn't have notations on there. And sometime I would say that the band made up arrangements, really. About time we get through adding what we had, the tambourine man, maybe they might have somebody to sing some of the licks in the same groove and phrases that the drummer did, and so forth and so on, and build the song and arrangement around that. And then later on came in some good arrangers, no doubt about it, Paul Rising and Wade Markers and a whole lot of them, Willie Shorter, a whole lot of good arrangers came in where they started arranging for horns and strings and everything. But the first was just a card sheet type of thing.
Do you have a favorite track of the ones you played on, a favorite track for what you're playing?
Well, the Pride and Joy, I did what I wanted to do on that. We'll say I played the piano. I started the introduction off by myself. Later on, they added some drums and some bass to the introduction and made it like, they could gimmick around and make it. But Pride and Joy was one of the tunes, the band track that I really did what I wanted to do. That's because, really, Marvin had played drums with me the night before, and I said, when we go in the studio again, I'm going to do my thing.
Well, why don't we hear Pride and Joy, the Marvin Gaye hit, and this is my guest, Joe Hunter, at the piano. We'll hear more from musicians Joe Hunter and Jack Ashford in the second half of the show. They're two of the musicians featured in the new documentary and performance film, Standing in the Shadows of Motown. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Universal Pictures, presenting The Emperor's Club, starring Kevin Kline. In every person's life, there is someone who makes all the difference, now in theaters everywhere. And by WorldCom, an update on management and policy is available at worldcom.com/update. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Joe Hunter and Jack Ashford, two of the Funk Brothers profiled in the new movie Standing in the Shadows of Motown. And we remember one of the founding fathers of Israel, Abba Iban. He died yesterday at the age of 87. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with two of the musicians featured in the new documentary, Standing in the Shadows of Motown. It's about the musicians who played on Motown Records, the musicians who became known as the Funk Brothers. The movie also reunites the surviving Funk Brothers in a concert featuring younger stars, such as Joan Osborne, Bootsy Collins, and Ben Harper, singing Motown hits. My guests are pianist Joe Hunter and vibraphone and tambourine player Jack Ashford. They both played with Marvin Gaye and loved working with him. Here's Jack Ashford.
Oh, he was very easy to work with because he was multifaceted as far as his creativity was concerned, not only as a player, but his ideas. Unfortunately, his untimely death, he hadn't even reached the first floor of his potential in creating, because you have to see him and see him work. See, he wasn't afraid to try something because he understood the philosophy of creativity was, if you try it, it doesn't work, try something else, you know? And by meeting the challenges of that, even the way he dubbed in his vocals on some of the tracks, whether he did them or not, was very unusual. I remember when he was doing I Want You. I was in the studio with him when he did I Want You. And the console was set up with a boom mic going over the front of the console down towards a couch in front of the console. He was laying on a couch. He was laying on the couch singing a song. And he was singing maybe two bars and say, stop, and say, okay, run that back. And Art Stewart was his producer and engineer, and if he liked it, he said, okay, let's go. And then they would go up to that point and punch it in. He'd sing another three lines and run that back. I mean, a lot of people don't know that particular song, he didn't sing it all the way through. He just punched in all over the place because he was going for a particular feel, and that way he could lock in the feel. So, you know, working with him in that area was fine. Then we did a song called Got to Give It Up, which I introduced a new instrument that I invented called a hotel sheet.
What's that?
It was a piece of high-impact styrene the size that was about 12 inches long, and it was around a 32nd of an inch thick, possibly. And it said, wook, 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 that kind of sound. So he was, when I got finished putting the tambourine on, got to give it up, he said, you got anything else in your bag, Jack, that we could put on there? I was already playing a Coca-Cola bottle. So I said, yeah, I said, I got something here. So I started playing. I said, hey, I like that. So you can hear that hotel sheet on that record. But when we got finished with it, he said, I like that. He said, what do you call that? And because he had to put on a session notes what I played, you know. And I said, I couldn't think of anything. So I said, just call it a hotel sheet. I said, because, you know, when you're a musician traveling on the road, those hotel sheets get pretty stiff after you go from one hotel to the other, so every musician can relate to that. I had no idea that title was going to stick. And so people, when the record came out and became a hit, people were calling Motown asking, what was a hotel sheet and where could they buy one? And so Marvin gave me the opportunity to do that.
I think we should pause here and hear that hotel sheet.
Okay, well, this song got to give it up in the second half of the song.
Okay, here it is. That's Marvin Gaye, Got to Give It Up, and that strange percussion known as the hotel sheet was played by my guest Jack Ashford, who was one of the Funk Brothers, the house band at Motown Records. Also with us is Joe Hunter, who is a pianist for Motown, and they're both in the new documentary, Standing in the Shadows of Motown. Now, Berry Gordy wanted to safeguard his Motown sound, and in the movie Standing in the Shadows of Motown, the musicians described this spy system that he developed to make sure that his musicians weren't also playing at other studios and getting their sound in other studios' records. Why don't one of you describe this spy system?
Well, I don't think Barry's the one that really came up with that.
Oh, he wasn't?
He could have been. I don't think so. Because I think Barry was so charismatic that I don't know whether he ever met him or not, but you had to like this guy That's for one thing. He was always, I never heard him say a harsh word. And I think a lot of people did things to impress him. But they took pictures of us going in and out of the studios. But I think it was initiated by some of his underlings who was just trying to go back and say, look, boss, I got pictures of these guys that are going into other studios. Of course, and he did whatever he had to do. But I think that's the way that happened. I think he took the hit for that, you know.
What was the punishment for playing with another studio?
Various types of fines, various types of intimidation, such as you'll be automatically fired if you're seen coming out of there again, or, you know, all types of things like that in order to get you to stop going out playing for other people. But as hot as we were, everyone was coming at us from around the planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hotels and motels made money just stacking people up, waiting like planes taking off, hoping that we would have a couple of hours to go in the studio and put something on their records.
Were both of you caught in the act?
I was caught a few times.
I wasn't ducking. I went over to Chicago and I did a wrong thing. I took some of the Motown band. We cut Johnny Lee Hooker, boom, boom, boom. And it was different places that I went with different people, you know. And actually, I didn't come back and tell him. I think it was some of the people, you know, that dog-eat-dog people that come back and say, hey, will you cash my check? And he says, oh, you've been over the VJs. Well, how did you get there? Well, Joe Hunter took us there, you know. That was somebody trying to get favors from Berry Gordy.
So how are you punished?
No, he made me stand up one time in a company meeting. He told me I was a company man. And he told everybody to concentrate and look at me. Says he's taking our sound over to Chicago. I said, I'm not taking your town. They just play good money. Curtis Mayfield and all them guys over in Chicago put me on some commercials and whatnot. And Jerry Butler, you know. And embarrassed me more so. He says, I'm going to forgive you this time, but don't do it no more. But I did it again.
My guests are musicians Jack Ashford and Joe Hunter, two of the musicians featured in the new documentary and performance film Standing in the Shadows of Motown. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are pianist Joe Hunter and tambourine and vibes player Jack Ashford, two of the musicians featured in the new documentary and performance film Standing in the Shadows of Motown. It celebrates the musicians who back the singers on Motown Records. I asked Hunter and Ashford if there were lots of love stories and feuds behind the scenes at Motown, and Ashford told this story.
The second time the Motown group went overseas, I was with them when this was after we went over with Kim Weston. Barry was with us. It was Barry, the Temptations, the Miracles, the Supremes, and Martha Reeves. So what happened was we were riding in this bus out in the hinterlands, and I was sitting behind Stevie over a wheel well, and the heat used to come off the manifold as I was getting plenty of heat, but it was cold outside, you know, and we had blankets. So Diana Ross was saying how cold she was up front because she was sitting right in back of Mr. Gordy. And so what happened was Stevie was saying, well, let's warm back here. Diana, you want to come back? So she says, okay. So she came back, but she couldn't sit with him because Ted, his assistant, was with him. So it wasn't the one sitting with me. So she sat beside me to get this heat. So we threw the blanket over us and everything. And Earl Van Dyke started insinuating that I'd end up having a long swim back over the English Channel if I didn't get her out of that seat. So Diana said, well, it's cold in this bus, you know. So next thing I know, Barry, the next day, in fact, Barry hired a limousine, a big Mercedes limousine, and put the Supremes in it. And he was in it with his assistant, and everybody else was in the bus. So he's following the bus.
And Martha Reeves got angry and started to stomp up and down the bus. I thought she's going to pull our picket signs and everything, talking about, what's wrong with the rest of us? We're cold, too. I said, well, the limousine won't hold everybody. So she ran and raved all the way across Europe.
So that's
she
funny.
And Genghis Khan. She had something in common with one of those big dictators like Napoleon or somebody, I guess.
Were you angry yourself?
No, I was too happy to have a job. And I had the heat also that did help.
Right. You know. Joe Hunter, any good soap opera stories you want to share?
Well, no. I've seen some things happen there in the studio. There was love, and there was something else when it wasn't love. In other words, the Funk Brothers was doing well, and some of the producers were sort of pushing one another one time. In other words, one producer went 5 or 6 minutes over his time, and the other producer came in and said, your time is up. You're going into my time. And so for it, know it, they was picking up chairs throwing at one another. They didn't want the Funk Brothers to get too tired before they get their job done, you know. We had to come between them.
Joe Hunter, how long did you stay at Motown?
Let's say around about 5 years and almost a half.
So you left, like around 63 or something?
Yeah, that's right, about the middle of 63. About the middle of 63. Even about the time I was leaving, Barry said, well, what position do you want? And I was going through some press changes, and I said, I don't want any position, Barry. I'm just leaving.
Why'd you want to leave?
Well, I was going through a whole lot of things. When a person's getting a divorce sometime and you think you're in love, it's depressing, you know, sometime. And you know, just wasn't thinking right, you know. If I could think it over again, I might make a different decision, you know.
And Jack Ashford, how long did you stay at Motown?
I stayed from 63 to, till they closed. You know,
till they closed in Detroit.
I took about a year's hiatus, and then I went back with Norman. And I stayed there till they left, and then I went out to California in 75, and I worked with them non-exclusively until 81, I'm sorry. Then I went with Whitfield Records, Norman Whitfield's company.
How did you do in L.A. when you moved out there with Motown?
Well, going out there, it was moving into a political system that existed that we could never break the barrier because they had a contractor, one of the major contractors was a guy named Ben Barrett. He was using guys on the Motown product that he was accustomed to using, and he didn't want to break that up. And he knew that if he put three or four of the Funk Brothers together, it would start dominating the sound. So when he did use the Funk Brothers, he would use one the most, mixed in with the David T. Walkers and the Joe Samples and guys like that, you know, and John Barnes, were very excellent musicians. I mean, I'm just enthralled the way they played. But the thing is, it neutralized the Motown sound. That sound out there was not the Motown sound.
You know, you both come from jazz backgrounds and then, you know, ended up playing on the Motown Soul Sessions. Did you like the recordings when you were doing them? I mean, it wasn't necessarily what you were used to hearing or doing. Did you automatically have a taste for it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I enjoyed it. Listening back to what we had did, you know, I enjoyed it very much.
And Jack Ashford?
I found it difficult at first making that transition because I was still jazz influenced, and the simplicity that was required to work at Motown, I would forget it sometime, and I would just put extensions on chords and augment the chords and enhance the chords, and Earl Van Dyke would be sitting over there breaking his face up looking at me, you know, because we could all see one another, and I would be in the middle of the floor facing the grand piano. Earl would be shaking his head and looking up in the air like somebody shot him or something whenever I put a flat five on a chord or something. He said, oh, man, you know, what is that? So he said, no, keep it simple. And after I adjusted to that, you know, keeping it simple, it was cool, you know, but it was very simple. I mean, the chords were rudiments. There was nothing difficult with the chords until Ashford and Simpson started coming in there, and that required a different type of approach. And Wade Marcus, the arranger, these guys would, even Paul, you know, they started to stretch out creatively with their chords, which is what really established the difficulty of people duplicating what we did, because there were great jazz backgrounds behind these records that were coming out, Reach Out and Ain't No Mountain High Enough and things like that. I mean, these required somebody with some skills to play, you know.
Are you still playing professionally now, or have you both retired?
This is Joe Hunter. Yeah, I've played ever since I left Motown. I've been playing at a lot of places, at Marriott Hotel in Troy, Michigan for 4 years. Out there with Chuck Muir for a couple of years in Dearborn, that's Fairlane. And down at for the Ethiopian guy in Greektown, Detroit, for a couple of years. And here and there, doing freelance work, you know, so forth.
Mm-hmm. Jack Ashford, what about you?
I hadn't played in 20 years.
Whoa, how come?
Well, I happen to live in Memphis, Tennessee, and there's no music there.
There's no music in Memphis?
No. Well, they play Elvis, Blue Suede Shoes, and Jailhouse Rock. But there's no venue there that will support, you know. Can you, when I first went there, you know who the first musician I met was? Phineas Newborn, the incredible Phineas Newborn.
The jazz pianist.
I thought I had died and gone to heaven. Because I was a great fan of his, and I happened to go to a bar one night, and he was playing. So I asked him to play a song for me, one of my favorite songs, Round Midnight.
Mm-hmm.
So he played Round Midnight with his left hand, and he played something else with his right hand, all at the same time. And so I said, oh, my goodness. So he was my great experience there. But after he died, there's no place there. See, that's a right-to-work state, so they don't play scale. Like, they give you a beer and a barbecue sandwich and $20, and they think you paid. So I wouldn't work for that, you know. So there's no place there to work.
So what have you been doing?
Well, I had a construction company. I went into the security business. I did everything unrelated to what I was trained to do. I was very depressed there. But I was there because my wife is from there, and, you know, after leaving California, I wanted to drop my family off there while we go come on to New York and Philly to find some recording work. But my family did so well that I didn't want to uproot them, so I stayed, you know.
Right. I'm wondering what it means to you, to each of you, to have this reunion movie and CD, Standing in the Shadows of Motown, in which you get to play with, you know, all the other surviving Motown musicians and do new versions of the old songs.
Yeah, it's a real great pleasure to do that. But like I said once before, we have a producer that wants some of the things originally just like they were. However, there are some things that we add to it when we add horns and strings and whatnot on certain tunes. But there are certain tunes that's got to be exactly like they were. Else we got a complaint coming, like they were back there in the early 60s. Yeah.
Jack Ashford, what does it mean to you to be reunited, you know, for this movie?
It was just a wonderful experience because these are the best musicians I've ever worked with in my life. And I miss them so much. You know, we shared a lot of wonderful things together during our time at Motown. You know, when you're making history, you don't know it because you're living it. In retrospect, when I look back on the things that happened, you know, had it not been for Motown, I would have never met Joe. And he's been such an addition to my life, and Benny and all those guys. And to see these fellas again in 2000 in that basement, that little basement, we were all, well, after we got past the tears and everything, we had to wonder, would we still sound the same, you know? It was a lot of in question there. And after they kicked the first song off, I said, oh, my God, we still sound the same. So I said, well, we're joined at the hip, so we better hope it pays off because we can't get rid of each other. So, but it worked, you know. And I think if you heard the CD and you remember back in the day and play those records, it sounds the same.
I want to thank you so much, both of you, for talking with us. Thank you.
Oh, we thank you so much thank for you. Having us.
Pianist Joe Hunter and vibraphone and tambourine player Jack Ashford are two of the musicians featured in the new documentary and performance film Standing in the Shadows of Motown. The film reunites the Funk Brothers as they play behind younger stars singing Motown hits. From the CD of the film's concert, here's Gerald Levert singing the Four Tops hit, Reach Out. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with Abba Eban, Israel's first ambassador to the UN. He died yesterday at the age of 87. This is Fresh Air. Abba Eban, one of the last central witnesses to Israel's birth, died yesterday at the age of 87. After World War II, he negotiated for an independent Jewish state with Great Britain, which had been administering Palestine under a League of Nations mandate since 1923. In 1947, Eban made the case for a Jewish state to the UN. When Israel achieved statehood, Eban became his country's first ambassador to the UN. He also served as Israel's deputy prime minister, minister of foreign affairs, and a member of the Knesset. I spoke with Abba Eban in 1992 after the publication of his memoir, Personal Witness, Israel Through My Eyes. At the time, peace talks in Madrid were stalled. Eban supported a two-state solution. How possible do you think a true and lasting peace is between Israel and its Arab neighbors and the Palestinians?
Well, first of all, it's a reality. It's a reality in relation to the Arab and Muslim state, which took the lead in all the wars against Israel. One must understand that a peace treaty with Egypt completely refutes the idea of the irreconcilability of conflicts. There is no such thing as an irreconcilable conflict. And therefore, peace is something of which you should never despair. Peace happens when there is a convergence of self-interest on behalf of a peaceful solution, and therefore it's an intelligent thing to do, to keep working at it, not to despair of it, especially when the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty has worked so well.
What has been one of the most difficult decisions you have had to make on issues of war and peace in Israel?
In 1967, we had to take a vote because here were the Arab states converging upon us, getting nearer and nearer to our population centers, intoxicated by the apathy of the international community. We had to decide when and if to vote for war. And I advocated restraint because I said, first of all, we must avoid a situation in which we win the war and are then thrown back, as we were in 1956, by a joint action of the United States and the Soviet Union. So I said, well, let me go to Washington and to Paris and to London and see if we can get support so that even if they don't help us in the field, which we never asked for, they wouldn't just throw us back. And therefore, I had to call for over nearly 3 weeks of delay. And then one day on the 5th of June, everybody had to vote. Our Prime Minister, Mr. Eshkol, said he wants everybody to vote for or against. You can't just dodge this issue. And I saw my hand going up with all the other hands. Yes, we were just going to war.
Why was it such a difficult decision for you to make to vote to go to war?
Because according to all the statistics, we had no certainty of winning. The fact that in 6 days we had this spectacular victory was always regarded as almost impossible. We thought that we would... people were... Our hospitals were prepared for tens of thousands of casualties. Graves were being dug. That was the atmosphere in which we then voted.
After the Six-Day War, you tried to begin peace talks with the Arabs. What did you try to do?
We thought, perhaps unrealistically at the time, that because they were so battered and defeated and demoralized, that that would be a good time for them to think of peace. Well, that turned out not to be true. Perhaps we shouldn't have believed that. It was the fact that they were defeated and demoralized that made it more difficult for them to come to the table, because they had lost their pride. And they had no reason to regard the military situation created by the Six-Day War as a realistic reflection of their strength. It didn't reflect their strength. And within a few months, they had replenished their arms. After all, no Arab government fell and no Arab capital was captured. And therefore, it was perhaps wrong on our side to believe that they would start peace negotiations on the basis of the extremely inferior balance of power which existed then. They had to restore their pride. Well, they did this, I'm afraid, at the expense of many Israeli losses in 1973. On the positive side, the fact that their pride was not humiliated made them more congenial for peace, and we did have a peace conference at Geneva in the end of 1973.
If the time wasn't right after the Six-Day War, what do you think makes the time right now for peace talks?
Well, it's right now because I would say that there's more humility in Israel and less depressive lack of confidence in the Arab states. Moreover, there's the attritional effect of time. If the Arabs had a chance of getting their territory back without peace, surely they'd have achieved that by now. And if Israel had a chance of getting peace while keeping all the territories, well, why hasn't that happened yet? And as I once said, and I noticed the Oxford Book of Quotations has quoted me as once saying that men and nations behave wisely once they have exhausted all the other alternatives. I really think that the Arabs and Israel have exhausted all the other alternatives except making peace with each other.
Abba Eban recorded in 1992. He died yesterday at the age of 87. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Book Magazine. In the current issue, editors pick their best of 2002, books, titles, and characters, in bookstores or at 800-317-2665. From Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of I, Richard by Elizabeth George, author of A Traitor to Memory, and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with Al and Tipper Gore. They've co-written a new book about the changing American family, and Al Gore is deciding whether to run again for president. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.